Welcome to CounselorAudioSource.net. Counselor Audio Source is a weekly podcast dedicated to the professional enhancement of practicing counselors, supervisors, and counselor educators. Look for us on the web at CounselorAudioSource.net. I'm Dr. Marty Gentius of Kent State University, and this week on Counselor Audio Source, contributing editor Dr. Shannon Dermer interviews Dr. Catherine Ford Sorey, both of Governor State University, about working with children in family therapy.
Well, Kate, tell me a little bit about how you got interested in the field of family counseling and therapy and in working with children specifically.
Okay, well, I got interested in the field of family therapy when I heard a lecture by Dr. Joseph Wechsler at Purdue, and he was talking about Mnuchin's research with psychosomatic families. And when I heard how you could actually measure physiological changes in children when they viewed their parents interacting, even though they weren't arguing, I thought this was phenomenal, and I just knew that that's what I wanted to be. So I really had a career change and left the field of teaching music and decided that I wanted to help children in a different way and to work with children and families.
So you were a music teacher before you got into the field of family therapy?
Yes.
Well, tell me a little bit about how you think being a music teacher helps you work with children now.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, I think what I enjoyed about being a music teacher was helping children to feel good about themselves and to get joy out of music. And so I used some really kind of strange and but creative, I guess, techniques, like maybe having a child lay under my grand piano and close their eyes while I played their piece, and they would get images in their mind that then they could use when they played the piece. So I think that it helped me be in tap more with my right brain and less with my left brain and not be so cognitively focused in working with children and families, but to, I think my years of teaching helped me understand that children think in pictures and images and metaphors, and they're concrete, and so talk didn't always cut it with them in teaching, and it doesn't cut it with them in therapy either. Can I tell you about the first case that I ever worked with and kind of how I got interested in working with children, specifically in family therapy? Because I was kind of proud that I was becoming a family therapist and I was going to counsel children and families, you know, using all these wonderful theories that I was learning. But in my first internship site, I was a couple months into it when I was told that I was going to do play therapy with a child. And I said, you know, what? I am not a play therapist. I'm a family therapist. And actually, I felt a little bit insulted at that point, which I'm ashamed of now when I look back on that. So the case that I was given was a child who was about 6 years old, and she had found her sister dead in bed one morning. And the parents were divorced, and mother was just very distraught and really not able to be there for this child. So my supervisor said I had to see the child individually while she would see the mother, and I had no clue what to do. With just some supervision, which was very helpful, and a little bit of guidance, I let the child teach me really what she needed to do. So it was kind of instinctive or intuitive. And we had a dollhouse at this agency, so this little girl would come in every week, and she would use the little dolls in the dollhouse and reenact the scene of finding her sister dead. She would take the mommy doll and have me be the mommy doll and tell me what to say, and then she would be the little girl, and she would come into the sister's bedroom and find her, and then call to the mommy, and I would say, "What should I say?" And she would tell me what to say, and then she'd have me come running in, and then she enacted how she called 911. Then she took a little car and brought it up to be the ambulance, and every week she would take a tissue like this and take that little child figure that was supposed to be her sister and put it in the tissue and wrap it up and put it in that car and drive it away. And then after a few weeks, she would enact the funeral and what happened there. But she was directing the play. She was really telling me what to do. She was my teacher, and she was the person that inspired me. But of course, during all this, I kept bugging my supervisor, when do I get mom in? When do I get mom in? And as mom had individual therapy, which really helped her to cope with her loss and decide how she could best help her child. Then I was able to bring mom in and incorporate her into the play sessions. And from that moment on, I was sold. I said, this is what I want to do. I want to study more about this.
So this little girl really taught you a lot about how to work with children. What about some of the experts and the professionals in the field? Who are some of them who taught you and helped you come to where you are today?
Well, in addition to Mnuchin, who I believe has been seminal in the whole issue of including children in family therapy, as one of the founding fathers, I think that one of my professors at Purdue Lafayette, Volker Thomas, was influential, as well as having read the book Dibs in Search of Self by Axline, that really changed my whole view of individual therapy and how valuable it is for children. Ileana Gill, though, I would say, is the leading proponent of play and family therapy, and she's probably had the most influence on me in recent years with how to work with children and include them in playful ways, as well as Risa Van Fleet. And one of my colleagues down at Purdue, Everett Bailey, he and I, we had a kindred spirit about children, and we enjoyed collaborating on a book chapter, and so he influenced me also. So those are the key people.
Now, you've mentioned that you see families together, but that also sometimes you'll see children alone or, you know, a parent alone. How do you decide who you invite to attend a family counseling session, and why do you make those choices?
Initially, I would tend to invite everybody that lives in the household to a session. That might be grandparents or an uncle who lives there. Unless the parents seem like they are really angry at a child and they want to spend time venting, and I don't want a child maybe to hear all that, and so I might just have parents come in for an initial session first. But generally, I would tend to invite everyone, the reason being so that I could see how they interact and see how the child's role fits with the families, maybe to be able to observe how they communicate and their nonverbal body language when they're talking about the IP, to be able to spread the symptoms and do, you know, all those things that we're taught to do in family therapy. But then I do propose a multimodal approach, and so that means that as we progress through therapy, I might meet with the couple alone or other subsystems like the siblings, maybe an individual parent at times as issues come up and as we progress. But I do feel it's important to always meet with a child alone, because even when family therapy is, quote, successful and we've maybe moved the child out of the position of being the scapegoat, or they're no longer entrenched in marital conflict, or the conflict isn't detoured through them, they could still have issues that haven't been addressed. In fact, we know that mothers are not the best judge of when their children are hurting. They often think kids are doing fine when in fact they're not. They might be anxious or depressed or worried or have a lot of fears, or they could be suffering the effects of abuse that hasn't been disclosed. So I think it's very important that we meet with children individually at some point just to assess how they're doing in school, with their peers, you know, just how they have learning disabilities, but we do need to meet with them and let their voices be heard.
Now, a lot of people would say that it's the children's parents or caretakers, whoever that may be, who really have the ability to, in a lot of ways, control the child's world. And so some people might say, you know, well, why not just have the people who really have the power and control? So why do you think it's so important to include children in that whole process?
Well, I think it's important to include children because they're vital family members. Too often their voices aren't heard. I think that historically, the founders of family therapy just recognized that you can't have family therapy without the presence of children. People like Haley have said that having children present are a way to enter the family and to bring about change, that they regulate the speed of therapy. Ackerman said without children, there can actually be no family therapy. People like Whitaker and Keith felt that families needed children to stay alive. And in fact, they said if a family didn't have a two-year-old, that they would go out and borrow one somewhere. And again, Mnuchin's, you know, work is just so important in seeing the role of children in family dysfunction. So I just feel we need to include children, maybe for two reasons, to work on their interpersonal relationships with their siblings and other family members, their parents, as well as intrapersonally to look at what's going on inside them that may not be evident to parents. For example, I directed a program for children and adolescents and families who had cancer in the family, and often parents would think that their kids were doing fine, and maybe mother was very ill and she'd lost her hair from chemotherapy and the kids were acting like everything was okay, but then they would enroll them in a children's group and we would find out very quickly that they weren't okay. They had a lot of worries, a lot of questions that they were afraid to ask their parents. And we forget that children, younger children, think egocentrically. And they have magical thinking, and a lot of times they're afraid that if they voice their fears, then what they're afraid of will happen, and that then they'll cause it to happen. So a child may be afraid to say, is the cancer going to kill my mommy? Is my mommy going to die? Because if it happens, then they'll feel responsible for it. So we need to find creative ways to help them express their fears through drawings, through toys, through group interaction, role plays. We need to help them be able to express what they're really feeling and thinking deep down. And then we need to help them be able to share that with parents. We need to prepare parents for it and coach them on how to comfort their children and answer their children's questions in age-appropriate ways.
Okay, so you're saying that including children helps you get a better and more realistic picture of the family, but it's also important for children themselves because sometimes the adults in a family aren't really good at gauging whether children need help or whether they need to come to, you know, counseling or not. So it's twofold. It's to help assess the family, get more information about the family, and also to help children who it may not be apparent that they need some help.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, if it's so important, if children really are the energy and the lifeblood of families, then do you think that counselors are always good at paying attention to children when they are there or including them in the counseling process?
No, unfortunately they're not, and there's several reasons for that, but let me just give you some statistics here. In one study by Corner and Brown that was done with family therapists back in 1990, they found that 40% of the family therapists in their study never included children, never. And 31% of them invited them to be present, but they didn't know how to engage them in the process of therapy, so they were just kind of sitting in the therapy room. They also found that 86.4% included children less than 25% of the time. So we can see that largely they're being excluded. Now, some of the reasons for that are that the clinicians in the Corner and Brown study said that they weren't comfortable with children. They just were not comfortable relating to children, and in fact Corner and Brown found that those who were least comfortable with children excluded children the most often. And then Johnson did dissertation in 1995, and she had a subsequent publication with Johnson and Thomas, I believe in 1998, and she reported that half of the respondents in her study made decisions to exclude based on their personal comfort level with children. It was more about the therapist's needs to be comfortable than it was about the children's needs to be included, and I don't think that's very ethical. So she found that those that were more comfortable included children more often, so kind of the converse of what Corner and Brown found. Corner and Brown also found that therapists in their study reported that they had not been trained adequately and they didn't have adequate supervision to work with children. They didn't have enough child-focused coursework, and that how the therapist perceived this training related to how they included children. And many in both of these studies reporting that their training was not adequate to prepare them to work successfully with children and families. And one more thing was these people didn't feel like they had a sense of competency. Johnson found that perceived competence strongly predicted whether or not they would include children, and that also mediated the relationship between actual training and inclusion. So that sense of competency, if we don't feel we can do a good job, if we're not comfortable, if we don't feel we've had the right training, we're not going to include them, or we're just going to have them sit in the corner of the room and try to be quiet, but they won't be active participants.
Well, I know that you've done some research on working with children, and also you teach a play therapy course at Governor State University, and you supervise your students in family courses where you help them to integrate children. Tell me a little bit about your research and your work, some important things about that.
Well, my research idea really came from Johnson's research in 1995, and I wanted to find out exactly what it would take to increase therapists' comfort level with children, their sense of competency, and what type of training and supervision really was needed in order to do that, in order to promote children being included. And so one of the things I looked at was, when should children not be included? I kind of made the assumption that they should be included. And my methodology was, it was a Delphi study, so I had a panel of experts who had training in various backgrounds in family therapy and child development and psychology, different theoretical backgrounds, all who had numerous publication and years of practice and had written quite a bit about child-focused family therapy or family counseling. And the first important finding was that they agreed that in general children should be included, except for a few exceptions. And those were when parents were discussing adult sexual issues, or when they were discussing sensitive topics and maybe deciding how they were going to share this information with a child. Perhaps an example might be a parent who's terminally ill. And so the parents might need to meet alone with the counselor to prepare how to share that information with the child. But they really emphasized, the panel emphasized, the importance of including children at some point, even if the issue wasn't anything about them, just to assess the impact that the problem is having on them. And so I think that was an important finding. Another area I looked at are what should be included in courses in training people to work with children, what readings are important, and what topics should be covered. And as far as topics, this panel really emphasized that clinicians need to have a theoretical knowledge of the importance of children in family sessions and the reciprocal impact of children on parents and parents on children, how we shape one another in our development. And they also needed to understand structural and boundary issues, issues of power and hierarchy. So that kind of hints at structural family therapy. They need to know how to engage children and families in practical ways, like maybe art or games or puppets. They need to know ethical issues regarding children and families, because there's some different issues when you're working with children and families around confidentiality and reporting. They need to appreciate and respect children. They need to be able to help parents and children communicate and connect and see how parental relationships affect children. They need to be able to assess children and treat them, and know how to use kind of standard family therapy treatment models to treat childhood problems, as well as common family therapy issues such as chaotic families and abusive families and families who've experienced trauma, divorce, step families, foster care, attachment issues, it just goes on and on, including illness and death in families. And they also emphasize the importance of contextual issues, like how is the child impacted by the school and the community, and how do professionals collaborate with other professionals in the school or medical professionals. Social issues like sex roles and gender issues, the role of peers, ethnic diversity, and of course the drug culture, because all of these issues impact parents and how they raise their children, and how the community is impacted by all those issues and the school is impacted. And I also want to emphasize that they found that multi-crisis families who are on welfare, live in poverty, have children in foster care, or are homeless, are areas that I don't think are addressed very often in training, but they're essential, and we need to know how to work with those families and those children.
Okay, you covered a lot of reasons why they should be included in the information that people should know. I supervise family counselors and family therapists also, and what I usually notice when they do include children, or I should say when they invite children, they're not necessarily included, that oftentimes the children are in session, but they're just kind of sitting there. They're not truly integrated or not truly engaged into the session. So what kind of knowledge and skills do you think that counselors and therapists need to have in order to truly engage the children and truly make them a part of the session?
Well, I think that there are certain attributes that counselors need to have to be able to work well with children. First of all, being that they need to like children. Children are really perceptive and they know. They know if you're not comfortable with them, and they know if you don't like them. And so to be able to genuinely like them and be able to tolerate ambiguity and their messiness, you know, and their noise at times, it can be difficult. But we need to kind of work on those skills. And we also need to respect them. I think children are so used to looking up at adults and being talked down to that they're disarmed when someone sits on the floor next to them and talks to them with a puppet, or plays a board game with them at the same level, or really is interested in what they think would make their family better, what maybe the miracle question of if they went to sleep tonight and a miracle happened and they woke up and the problems that brought them in today were gone, what would that look like and what would that mean for them? They're not used to being listened to on that level. And when we do that, we're respecting them deeply. We're listening to them. And we're also modeling for parents that children are important and they have wishes and needs that need to be acknowledged and made part of the counseling process. So other skills, I think counselors need to be able to join with adults and children simultaneously, and that can be difficult. A lot of our words can go right over children's heads. We use big words and they sit there and nod and they don't have a clue what we're talking about. Children are just so concrete. One of my colleagues and collaborators, Nancy Bianc, who's worked with children with illness and death, had a child who came back from his father's funeral and said, "Yeah, I went to that place where they cut my dad in half." She said, "What?" And he said, "Yeah, you know, he was in that box and he was cut in half." And she realized that what he was talking about was the bottom half of the casket was closed, but the top half was open. And so this child assumed that daddy was cut in half. So we forget how they think. We forget their concreteness. And we need to be reminded of that. So we need to be aware of their roles in the families. And we need to look to the children for cues as to what connects with them. You know, do they like games or do they like puppets? Do they like close contact or more distance? Do they like eye contact? Are we better off to sit side by side with them and maybe do a scribble drawing with them or make up a story with them? So we need to take cues from children, and that's another way that we can respect them. One other thing I think that's an important skill is really regarding parents during this process. And I don't want it to look like the focus is just on talking with the children while the parents are just observing, because I don't think that's important. I think that's not good. But we need to be sure that parents never feel blamed or criticized, or that we don't outshine them in some ways. For instance, if we ask them to quiet their children so we can hear what they're saying and they're ineffective in it, and so we take over and we quiet the children, we've just disempowered them. And so we need to be careful not to do that. We need to keep the focus, I believe, on helping children relate things back to their parents and parents to their children and strengthening the connections there. It's always more important for me to have children more connected to their parents than to me. I don't want to be the agent of change as much as I want to empower the parents to be the agent of change, which is one reason why I really like filial therapy. If anyone's interested in that, Risa Van Fleet has written quite a bit about that. But that's where you actually train parents to be the play therapists for their children in non-directive play, where they mirror back their child's behavior, their actions, as well as their emotions. And there's a lot of research that it has helped children with a wide variety of issues, especially attachment issues, but ranging from behavioral problems and enuresis, encopresis, divorce, stepfamily issues. So it's a really wonderful way to create attachment bonds and also to empower parents to be the change agents for their children.
Throughout that conversation, or throughout what you were just saying, it was really obvious that structural family therapy has had a big influence on you, and that you combine structural and play therapy together. I mean, you talked about, you know, respecting the hierarchy, you know, respecting the authority of the parents. You talked about accommodating to the family's style, as well as to children's style of communicating, which is usually through play and metaphor. And you also talked about having them all see how they're all connected to each other. And those all seem very structural concepts. One of the things you talked about, though, which is a major structural concept, is joining. And you talked about joining with the parents and respecting their authority, and also joining with the children. And at first, it sounds like those might be mutually exclusive, that the same way that you might join with the caretakers or with the adults isn't the same way that you'd do that with children. But then you mentioned filial therapy, where you kind of help the parents or the caretakers to play with their children, be involved in the process. And all that was leading up to the question of how comfortable are adults with play and with that form of communication?
That's a good question. In fact, I asked Ileana Gill that question when I interviewed her. And I think that some of us have forgotten what it's like to play. But I think that if the therapist can model their own playfulness and creativity and encourage parents to try it for the sake of their children. Most parents really love their children and want to help their children. And so most of the time, if we convince them that this is helpful and this is how we work, they can be convinced to at least try it. But for some, it's more difficult. Most of us played as children, and so we've got that untapped inner resource that if we can help parents go back and tap into their childhood experiences, that wonderment, that sense of make-believe, and the what-ifs that we all experienced as children, we can model that for them by being playful. But most of the time, I think parents are ready now. Whether or not they can really get into the play and make it valuable where they're able to express the problems through the metaphor of the play or through, say, doing a family sculpt, might be a different story. I do remember working with a family. Actually, I was supervising the case behind the mirror, and we were trying to get them to do a family puppet interview, and they were supposed to create a story that had a beginning, a middle, and an end, but wasn't a story that they knew, like Cinderella, and they had to use puppets and act out the story for the counselors after they had made up the story and had some time to practice it. And this family just absolutely could not do that task. The mother would take her two puppets and make up a story where her two puppets were talking back and forth, but she wouldn't cooperate with the other family members, so the children and the father were kind of left out of the process and very frustrated by it. And just like in anything in counseling, if it doesn't work, you stop it. Certainly if it becomes in any way maybe has the potential to be harmful to somebody in the family, you stop it and you do something different. But I think most of the time we can encourage parents, and we can also teach them how it's beneficial to them to connect with their children and to be more creative. I love playing with my grandchildren. I love doing, you know, they call it special playtime, where it's one-on-one and I'm just watching them and mirroring back what they're doing, kind of the filial idea. And we connect that way, and it creates a bond that just isn't there, just through other activities that we do together. So I just think it's a shame that it's not taught to all parents. I think all parents should have a training manual that comes with them with their baby, and that they're encouraged to do these types of play with their children.
Now, you had mentioned that we all have the inner resource of that we're all children. We all thought in this way at times. And yet it sounds like you're talking about that there's different kinds of play. There's directed play, there's non-directive, that kind of reflective play that you talked about, where you're not trying to get the children to do anything, you're just kind of mirroring what they're doing. And so in some ways it sounds like, well, this is simple. And on the other hand, it sounds like there's some definite knowledge and techniques that you need to know. So do you think that a family counselor or family therapist has to be an expert in play therapy to utilize it well?
Well, that's a very good question. And actually, no, I don't think they have to be an expert in play therapy. I think that there is a difference between playfulness and play therapy. In fact, Mnuchin pointed that out after my study, and he really talked about using playful language and using the language of metaphors and big and tall, like he's so famous for doing, you know, having a child stand up on a chair and talk about how the child got power by maybe standing on the shoulders of one parent. So there's playful language. Play can be seen kind of on a continuum. Maybe on one end you might use playful language, you might use play to engage a child. For instance, maybe going out into the waiting room, having them bring a favorite toy from home, and bringing a puppet and talking to their toy through your puppet to engage them initially. You could use certainly play toys in your office to keep them quiet while you are talking to parents, and then you can use play for intervention, which is play therapy. So there's different ways to use play, but playfulness, we all have a quality of playfulness in us, and it's reconnecting with our right brains and the metaphors and avoiding the left brain of trying to always process things and think things through. Although it is important to know how to process play, and the most important thing, which Ileana Gill has discussed at length, is the ability to stay in the metaphor. So that if a family, let's say, has done a family puppet interview and they've made up a story, in some way that story almost always is going to reflect the content of their problem, but it's going to be in a metaphor. So it might be too difficult for them to talk about, let's say, an impending divorce directly, and what that will mean, the changes that are going to come, and how the children feel caught in a conflict. It may be too hard to talk about that directly, but they can enact it by choosing puppets, and maybe the little lamb puppet can talk about how scared she is because she doesn't know where she's going to live, and the mama bear puppet can reassure her that she'll always have a place to live and she'll always be loved. So they can communicate through metaphors in ways that are safer, and help sidestep some of that resistance that they might be experiencing to talk about things directly. I just wanted to say one more thing about processing play activities, and that is that sometimes you don't have to talk about what it means. Sometimes you can ask families, do you think in some ways this story relates to you? But that's after you've stayed in that metaphor and you've talk to the wolf and had the wolf talk to the badger and the badgers talk to the lamb, and you've really explored the relationships and the storyline in the metaphor. And then sometimes that's enough. Sometimes they don't have to take it to that next level of, yeah, that's us and this is what we're experiencing. I think that the stories can be very powerful. I remember one case of a family where the father had been removed from the home because of sexual abuse, accused sexual abuse with non-family members, and the mother was devastated and refused to tell the children anything. And for about the first four sessions, we didn't get anywhere with them in talking or in playing because there was such a no-talk rule that they were terrified to share anything. And it wasn't until the mom finally engaged with them in a puppet interview that they were able to express the fears through the puppets, what the puppets were feeling. It also brings to mind a case that I was supervising live, and this case involved a mother who had cancer, single mother, and she had two children and had to tell the children that she was giving up custody to a grandparent and moving away to live with someone else and terminating her parental rights. And she just couldn't find the words to do it, but we did it sitting on the floor using bear puppets. And so she explained to the mama bear explained to the baby bears what was going to happen. The baby bears asked questions for about 40 minutes, and then once the baby bears were able to express their concerns and their fears, and the mama bear reassured them that grandma bear would always be there to love them and that the mama bear would visit and that she would be okay, then they were eventually able to bring it into reality, and she was able to explain to them that that's what was going to happen in their lives. And because they had experienced it in that what-if, that make-believe world, and explored it, it was safer then for them to talk about their own real feelings. So I don't think you have to be an expert, but I think you have to be in touch and attuned with children and their ways of relating and thinking, and allow them to lead you and allow them to teach you. And there's one more thing that we haven't talked about that I think is really important about play, that Ileana Gill really emphasizes this, and that's the importance of miniaturizing things. That problems can seem so immense to adults and to children, but when a child draws a picture of their problem, or they take a sand tray and they choose miniatures and they depict that scene in a sand tray, then they've reduced it in size and it's contained and it's manageable and they can manipulate things. and they're in control, and it's empowering. And that in itself is so therapeutic for both adults and children. So having families build a world together in the sand, maybe a world before a divorce, a world now, and maybe their ideal world, is a way to expect positive change and help them concretize and see what that change will look like. And they're able to manipulate it because it's miniaturized and it's contained. And I don't think you need to be a real expert in that, but I really do think people need training to be comfortable and to feel competent. And so part of the research showed that soul-focused training and workshop training are essential components of training, as well as supervision. So I encourage people to go to workshops with Ileana Gill and Risa Van Fleet and other good play therapists, and to go back and look at some of the videos of Sal Mnuchin and Jay Haley when they worked with children and included children, and of course Virginia Satir, and how she used touch and connectedness and sculpting to promote family communication and intimacy.
So you think people can integrate play and include children, their way of communicating, without having necessarily being trained solely as a play, you know, counselor?
Yeah, in fact, I'd like to just inject this, and that is that we've talked about structural and play therapy, but I think you can integrate play into any of the theories of family therapy, certainly into solution focus. And Therese Steiner has a great book with Insoo Kim Berg on child focus or solution focus work with children. You can use it with narrative. You know, Michael White's work has been terrific in externalizing the problem. Lee Schultz has done some wonderful things with externalizing and scaling questions with children. So you could use it with experiential, certainly. Whitaker, you know, used children a lot. You could integrate play therapy to make children be more fully alive. So it isn't just with structural, but really whatever your theoretical orientation is, you can integrate play. I look at family play therapy as a meta model that can be used within the other therapy that we've all been trained in.
Okay, so you're saying that counselors and therapists then can take the models that they already use. They don't have to be, you know, a play therapist. They can take the models that they already use as family counselors or family therapists and then find ways to integrate play in the service of joining with children and families and also in service of the goals of their model. So it sounded like you said the basic skills that they need to have are the ability to be playful, which most of us have that ability. We might just kind of stifle it a bit. The ability to be playful, to stay in the metaphor and not jump to interpreting things that they do, but to stay in the metaphor.
Oh, you just brought up an important point, and that's that we can never assume that we know what a child means when they draw something or when they say something, because it can mean something quite different. Well, let me give an example that Oaklander has used in her book. She uses gestalt, a gestalt technique with children, and she gave an example of a child who was given a piece of paper and asked to draw, I think it was a picture of her world, and she just used one little corner of the world. So we might interpret that to say, boy, this child has low self-esteem, she's off in a corner, you know, not in the center of the picture, she, you know, is constricted. But when Oaklander asked her, tell me about the rest of the paper, she said, oh, well, that's for the rest of my life because I'm only 10, so that's the rest of the paper that I'll use. So we really have to be careful not to interpret children's work, but to ask those open-ended questions, never asking why questions, but how, what, when, where. Tell me about your picture. Tell me about this aspect of your picture.
Instead of assuming that
yes.
You know, you should always check out any ideas that you have. Not make any assumption and ask them to explain their picture, you know, their story, their clay, whatever it is that they've been using.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'd just like to wrap all of this up by asking you, if you could give only one piece of advice to clinicians who would like to be better at engaging children, what would that piece of advice be?
Well, this is easier said than done, but I think to relax and be comfortable not knowing, to talk less, to play more. And Zilbach said it best. She said that children are wonderful teachers, and we can allow them to teach us to play. And so that would be my advice. And to get that training, to go to workshops and get comfortable, because the more comfortable you are, the more effective you're going to be.
Great. Thank you very much.
You've just heard an interview of Dr. Catherine Ford Sorey by Dr. Shannon Dermer regarding working with children in family therapy. Look for previous podcasts, show notes, and listener feedback on the podcast website at counselaraudiosource.net. Listeners can leave comments or questions for our interview guests or hosts through our Skype.com internet telephone ID, Counselor Audio Source, or by calling 330-871-4242. Counseling techniques and interventions discussed in the Counselor Audio Source broadcast are meant for use by counseling professionals, and Counselor Audio Source is not held liable for any use of the techniques mentioned in the program. Our music bed today is Memorial Day from Jamie Beauchamp. His and other PodSafe music can be found in the PodSafe Music Network at podshow.com. Counselor Audio Source is licensed under the Creative Commons, a nonprofit organization offering a flexible copyright for creative work.